From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Absorbing the news can be rough. Combine a 24/7 barrage of instantaneous alerts and updates with a barrage of chaotic happenings. Families separated at the southern border, angry presidential tweets, a fire at Notre Dame. Yet life is made up of other events as well. And my guests today seek to draw attention to welcome developments, but not with stories pulled from rejected plots for the Hallmark Channel. This hour, On Point, journalists pursuing seriously positive news. Join us. What kinds of news stories would you welcome? What stories are overlooked? And where do you find positive news? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear about the cultural import of Notre Dame Cathedral de Paris, badly damaged but remarkably still standing. Joining us first today in the studio is David Beard. He has a long career in journalism, working as a foreign correspondent and as a digital editor and writer at the Boston Globe, the Associated Press, among others. In 2014, he started the Washington Post's Optimist newsletter. He now writes for Mother Jones's Recharge newsletter. David, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
So I guess the place to start is at the beginning, as they say in The Sound of Music. Let's talk a little bit about the inspiration for The Optimist. Before you started, what were you seeking? What were you thinking about?
I was thinking about what kind of business do we run that serves only an unremitting tale of woe? You know, the monocrop of sadness delivered it, for newspapers. Often it would be the big Sunday paper for people who like to sit in the darkness on beautiful sunny Sunday mornings. Didn't seem like a recipe for success for our field. The world was bigger than this, and there were other ways to combat learned helplessness that we got from too much sad news.
So, you know, before this, you had been a foreign correspondent abroad. You'd been where?
I'd been in Argentina and had covered the Caribbean, ran the Caribbean for the Associated Press during Haiti, some Cuba, big stories, the beginning of Chavez.
And prior to launching The Optimist, you were a digital editor at The Washington Post. And obviously, 2014 is right after this incredible recession. So not only is there a barrage of bad news generally, but there had been really a tough time in the country.
Right. And the sort of civil war politically was happening. There was sort of no movement for anything from one side or the other in stalemate in Washington. So
what was your pitch? You go to your bosses and say, hey, guys, I want to do what exactly?
Hey, guys, imagine we're CBS Sunday Morning, but instead of 1974, it's today. Instead of a wood-paneled rec room where you have to watch this on a Sunday morning, you're getting inspiring stories on your smartphone as you're waiting for a coffee at Starbucks at about 11 on Sunday, feeling vaguely guilty for not going to some religious observance that weekend and feeling a little rudderless because you need some direction to get you through the week.
So that first day, that first week, what would you have been seeing coming streaming through your cell phone?
Yeah. The first week of The Optimist, mm-hmm. I was so afraid. I thought we'd have to go to the archives to I found 80 stories from the previous 6 months that I thought I could do the best of if we didn't have five good stories a week. Basically, the subtext was, here's five stories or six stories a week that don't make you want to kill yourself. And I thought that was probably the one floor elevator pitch, and so I think that. But I found them, and I found that there were stories not on page one. It didn't bleed, so it didn't lead, but it was there on A8, or it was there somewhere else in the paper. You just had to look harder for it and find different sources. So since then, I've been keeping a subset of stories I follow that are positive.
Before we get to the format that you decided to adopt, how receptive were bosses at the Washington Post? If I'm not mistaken, Marty Baron was already there, legendary executive editor of the Washington Post. You know, it sees itself as a national paper. I believe it had already been owned, acquired by Jeff Bezos as a personal acquisition. That's, of course, the founder and one of the richest people in the world, Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, I should say. What kind of reception did you get for this?
I had a fairly positive reception, both from Marty, with whom I'd worked in Boston, and we'd worked on some of these ideas when I ran the website for the Globe, and then also with Kevin Merida, who is then the number two and now runs the Undefeated for ESPN. So it just took a little while to get the mechanics together, to get to get a newsletter list, to get a story out, and to do things both as a newsletter and as an article.
Mm-hmm. And so you present it as a newsletter, an electronic newsletter. I mean, incredible number of Americans use them. But for those listeners who don't know, what is an electronic newsletter? How does it arrive?
Right. It's something you sign up for and boom, in your email inbox at 11 a.m. Sunday, you would get The Optimist. I literally stole some of the thoughts from something called Sunday Screens, which goes to 2 million members of the National Geographic of great images that help people on Sunday kind of get renewal in their lives. And it has an incredible, what you would call open rate. That's the number of people who actually click on the message to open the email. And I thought, well, the Washington Post doesn't have that history of images that National Geographic does, but it does tell stories. Mm-hmm. So we could do it as a text-based thing.
So pick a couple of classic examples.
Okay. I think that we had – you'll get a later guest on from Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. That paper, the Star Tribune, did a story, a last interview with the founder of the Little Free Libraries. He just had an idea of little wood boxes that you could put in your front yard and put books on. And he talked about his life and this crazy idea that went to 88 countries and hundreds of thousands of people now and how it's enriched communities worldwide. And we got an outpouring from little free library adherents around there. Another story about a inmate who went to prison for a crime he didn't commit, started drawing golf scenes from TV. He'd never been to a golf match before. He was from central Buffalo. And Golf Digest and the warden, these paintings were so incredible that Golf Digest took an interest in his case and won his exoneration. And then he determined he would help exonerate other inmates too.
Mm-hmm. We've got a comment from our website. Josh writes, until the if it bleeds, it leads mindset of the media falls by the wayside, the occasional token piece of good news is going to do little to mitigate the bad vibes from the other items of fire and brimstone that surround it. At this point, the greatest service the media would do would simply be to cease exaggerating the severity of headlines or inflating the likelihood of catastrophic outcomes from everything boring or from otherwise boring or benign stories. Trump makes few good moves, but everything he does, for example, isn't calamitous. Yet the media has some folks sincerely believing his presidency is a countdown to the apocalypse. With seemingly every breath he takes. How do you distinguish between a story that is cloying to a story that's going to land?
Right.
And how do you distinguish between something that is just sort of used to artificially leaven the diet with something that might have some meaning for its readers and listeners and viewers?
Right. Some people are in intensive care, I think, of help. They need that video of pandas cavorting or puppy dogs returning. That's not my stock and trade. It has to be something that isn't just Pollyannish, that will also prepare them for resilience for the rest of the news of the day. You can't bury your head in the sand for an hour and then be better prepared for the rest of the day. You have to show that justice occasionally prevails, or that people who think of others sometimes succeed. So a lot of it is that.
We now have with us from Encino, California, Lori Lakin Hutcherson. She's a producer and writer for film and television. Back in 2010, she started a website, and back then it was a Facebook page called Good Black News. Lori, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you so much for having me, David.
Thanks for joining us. So, Lori, what was the inspiration for your site? What were you trying to achieve?
Well, initially, I didn't even know I was going to create it. I was working in my capacity as a writer and producer. I was working with the novelist Terry McMillan and adapting her novel into a screenplay, mm-hmm. Not Waiting to Exhale, but the sequel to it. And she happened to mention that she saw a story about a group of young men in Chicago at an academy where 100% of the senior class had matriculated to college. But she wasn't seeing the story in any mainstream press anywhere, and how there was never any kind of coverage of these great positive achievements by African Americans. You only saw the negative things. So I said, well, I'm sure there's some good black news site out there that is covering them daily. I'll find it for you and I'll send you the link. Well, I did a search later on that day, and there was nothing like that. There was no site anywhere that I could find that focused solely on positive African American news. And I was like, this is 2010. This is ridiculous that it doesn't exist. So I'll just start a Facebook page and start finding or curating articles about this subject and put it up because it needs to exist somewhere. And I'd started doing that, and all of a sudden, people organically started following me who I didn't even know. And I started getting messages from people saying, thank you so much for this. I need this. I want to share this with my family. My sons don't know this history. They don't know these kinds of things. I was able to get out of bed today because I saw a story on your site. I was getting that kind of feedback. And I just was like, wow, I'm really touched a nerve that I didn't know I was going to touch. And I can't let it go. I felt like it was a divine responsibility in some sort of way that I was led to, and it just grew from there.
So, Laurie, in about the 30 or so seconds we have left before the end of this little segment, we're going to have you hold on for us. How did it grow?
Well, I was working on a television show, and then there was on hiatus, so I decided to build a dedicated website because I had, at that point, I think 3,000 or 5,000 Facebook followers, and I was like, I need for there to be a place for it not to be ephemeral. There should be an archive. There should be a place where people can search and find things, so let me just create a dedicated website. So I did that, and then around social media, Good Black News was available, so I picked it up on Twitter, on Tumblr, on Pinterest, everywhere, so I could just blast it out
and
from
now,
the main webpage.
And now I think you said you had something like 100,000 monthly readers?
Exactly.
We're discussing the push for more positive news. You've been hearing from Laurie Lakin Hutcherson and David Beard. We'll be joined in a moment by a newspaper editor who's gone that way as well. You can join our conversation. How do you consume your news? How do you feel about the 24/7 news cycle and how well it serves you? Where do you find balance? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the news and the drive for more positive coverage. You can join our conversation. What good news stories have struck you lately? Where do you turn to for an antidote to bleak news stories? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with David Beard. In 2014, he started the Washington Post's The Optimist newsletter. He now writes for Mother Jones's Recharge newsletter. And we've been speaking also with Laurie Lakin Hutcherson. She stays with us. She's a writer and producer for TV and film. She's also the founder and editor-in-chief of the website Good Black News. Now, from St. Paul, Minnesota, we're joined by Gail Rosenblum. She's worked as a journalist for 40 years, most recently as a columnist, and now is the editor of the Star Tribune's new Inspired section there in Minneapolis. Great, Gail, it's great to have you here with On Point.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so delighted to talk about this.
A lot of glorious G's in that sentence. So, Gail,
that's all right.
Tell me a little bit about your section. What is it called?
Sure.
What inspired it?
Sure.
And what are you doing with it?
What inspired it is, called Inspired.
Mm-hmm.
It started a year ago, a little over a year ago. It is a print a section every Saturday, 4 pages, sometimes goes up to 6, filled with these kinds of stories. And really, the impetus for it was our executive editor, Renee Sanchez, was just hearing, and you've been sort of talking about this for the last several minutes, just readers just begging, really, please, please give us some relief. And he listened. And he, with other top editors in the newsroom, started thinking about what can we do to respond to this incredible need from our readers. And so in January of 2018, we launched Inspired. I took over last summer, so I've been at it almost a year.
So tell me the kinds of stories that readers would find there. Because I think one of the things as I've been a reporter since – good Lord, 91 or something. One of the tough things to do is, you know, people say in the beat, you know, find positive stories.
Yeah.
How do you define that in a way that's not just say, hey, somebody gave a little bit of money to a charity or,
yes.
you know, a celebrity was
yes.
nice to a child. Those are yes. nice things. Those are good things. We should encourage them. But they don't strike me necessarily as being inherently newsworthy, even if they make for a nice photo or a nice little television clip.
Yes, and I'm glad you asked that because I think it is there's sort of a misconception that good news is fluff, it's soft. So what I like to talk about more is problem-solving, solutions-based journalism. There actually is a lot of research behind what all of us are doing here, which is that you can give people – you have to explain as journalists sort of the social ills in our society. That is our mandate as journalists. But if we don't also give people hope and sense of problem solving, then we really aren't doing our full job. And I think we've been hesitant to do that for a long, long time. But more recently, I think more people are embracing the idea of solutions-based journalism as a part of our jobs as journalists. And I just want to say something just interesting. Yesterday, I was very proud of my colleagues who were finalists for a Pulitzer. And what was interesting was they did a story on sexual assault cases and getting young people getting no response to their sexual assaults. But their final two installments were solutions-based installments in this 9-part series. And so I think that is what you're going to start seeing is these deeply investigated reports by journalists. But at the end, you're going to see some solutions-based reporting done as well.
Want to take a couple of calls. The lines are lighting up. We've got a call from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Raymond, go right ahead.
Hi. I want to bring up an issue, the juxtaposition of the good news over the bad news. Our local newspaper, this was a few years back, on a morning when 6 Marines had been killed in one roadside bombing in Iraq, instead the local paper went with some feel-good story about the Green Bay Packers, and then the Marine story was buried further within the paper, and that is something I do not want to see. I want the important news to be first, and then give us a moment to breathe, and then go ahead with the good news. But if you try to put both issues side by side, it's very desensitizing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I want to throw that to our folks here. Thanks for raising that, Raymond. What do you say about that, David Beard?
I mean, I think that it it depends. I guess the last year or two, I feel like that hasn't been as much of an issue. I think that we've been propelled by just a tsunami of negative news or combat news. I can see how disorienting it is, and side by side it could be. I look at it on my end as sort of trying to even up the balance or even get like a beachhead in of something that says journalists do things that provide a public good as well as sort of commentate on the latest tweet by the president. So it's trying to build sort of a broader view of this. I'm former correspondent and war correspondent. So yeah, obviously I see the importance of our work abroad and maintaining it. So I can totally get your point, but the way I see it is I'm one of the understaffed people who's trying to right a wrong to keep the business floating.
I want to take a call now from Baltimore, Maryland. Frank, go right ahead.
Hello. I was a journalist in Baltimore and Washington for some 20 years. And when I was in Baltimore, I had a weekly feature called Making the Grade. It seemed to me that teachers, administrators, schools were having a similar set of problems. And so we got feedback from them, and we'd pick out a story each week that was solution-based. And my sense was that if you put this out there on the air, then other schools and other teachers may seek to replicate that success. And it won 4 Maryland State Teachers Association School Bell Awards in a row. And then when I got to Washington, they were building the National Cathedral still. And I invited all my Facebook friends to, if you haven't gone there, go visit it now while we're all thinking about Notre Dame. But there was one story about an apprenticeship program they put together for stonecutters because they were aging out. They wouldn't have enough labor left to complete the job. And another of a national competition for elementary school students to design gargoyles and grotesques for that building, and one in one of our market areas won. It was a commuter under a rain an umbrella standing in the rain. You know, once again, stories with value, stories that are interesting, stories that tell you a little bit about what's going on in your readership area or your broadcast area.
Frank, just before we let you go, I was for a number of years the television media writer for the Baltimore Sun. Tell us your full name and what station you worked at in Baltimore.
Sure. Frank Bond. I worked for WBAL.
Frank Bond, WBAL. Yeah. Thanks, Frank, and nice to give you a shout-out. Lori Lakin Hutcherson, tell us, you know, you mentioned Frank had talked about the importance of education stories, and you had actually said inspiration was about a story about graduation rates at a school in Chicago. Tell us about the kinds of stories that you try to highlight that, you know, as we talked about with Gail, that distinguish from a nice event or a nice thing to a real story that you think deserve attention for your 100,000 readers.
Well, education stories, I mean, you nailed it on the head in terms of particularly with the African-American community. Those always resonate because it's something that everybody feels that they can achieve. So it always gives a bit of hope and inspiration to hear about the senior citizen who went back to school after raising a family of six on, you know, a very small income and then got their degree, or the 14-year-old wunderkind who got accepted to, you know, six colleges, or the homeless student who now is going to Harvard. Those stories always resonate because in the African-American community, education has always been one sure way to change your circumstances. So those really resonate in a big way. In terms of solutions-based journalism, it's really difficult when there are moments like the Charleston massacre, Trayvon Martin happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, based on the editorial philosophy, you can look at those issues of gun violence, of white supremacy, and do kind of what Martin Luther King called, where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. How do we respond to this sort of travesty and tragedy? And I think, as everybody has been saying on this panel, that you can look at stories that have very serious underpinnings and they're very serious social and political problems, but look at them with a solutions-based eye and say, this is what you can do in your community. This is what, you know, you can demand of your representatives. This is an actionable way to change things. So that's what we look at, particularly when we're doing our original writing and our original commentary and editorials, in addition to features such as one on, you know, there's the maternal death rate for African-American women is very high right now. So what are the solutions to that? And so that's how we end up covering serious topics, but always with an eye towards this is how we're going to try and solve the problem, and these are things that you can empower yourselves to do to solve these problems.
Dave Beard, you want to weigh in here?
Sure. That's exactly what Lori describes is exactly what we try to do as well at Recharge. We find the state that has done something positive about maternal mortality and jump on it as to how it happened. We talked to kids in Utah who got their state legislators, this red state, to do something on climate change. We talked to the little kid in Atlanta who had a lemonade stand and the money from the lemonade stand went to help migrant kids who were stuck at the border. So it sort of builds the agency of people that they can do something to make their nation better.
Appreciate that. I want to take a couple of quick calls now. I want to take a call from Fremont, Nebraska. Dean is calling. Dean, go ahead.
Yeah. I really appreciate to be a part of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I've dedicated the last 18 years of my life of exploring 58 countries, and I bring back stories to inspire our kids to have hopes and dreams, because what I call it is the negative narrative that takes the oxygen out of our curiosity to be engaged in the world. But the world's far more kind and beautiful and generous than what it's given credit for, but mm-hmm. that's just never really what makes the headlines most of the time. It's mm-hmm. kind of buried in there. And it kind of leaves us disempowered, and it doesn't really inspire us to be our best self. So I'm really glad that we're talking about this, because I think it's really important to bring a voice to the things that really matter. And what really matters is how we can band together and be a better version of ourselves. I mean, I'm in Nebraska. We definitely have had our share of hard times with all the flooding, et cetera. But we can use these to transform us to grow. But it comes from having conversations and remembering the things that are really important.
Thanks for that, Dean. We appreciate it. Want to take another call from Detroit, Michigan. Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I think it's an extremely important topic, and I'm glad you guys are covering it. I'm a recent graduate from a media psychology program, and what we see with the 24-hour news, you find these stories, and it is that if it bleeds, it leads mentality, and what that does is stimulates our emotional attention in somewhat of a negative way. So when you have these positive stories, it's not so much to make people feel good, but rather to give a more holistic perspective. And I find it also interesting that this topic also covers what is happening in the pathways of positive psychology, focusing on what helps us thrive and what helps us do our best and be our best. So thank you so much for covering this topic.
Well, thanks so much for listening and calling in, Dan. We appreciate it. I want to offer a couple comments from our website. Sandra Marcus 6 says she tapes and watches two national news programs, David Muir and Lester Holt. That's ABC and NBC, respectively. The last story, she says, is often a good news story that shows humanity is not dead yet. Those stories give me hope. I often fast forward through the first 10 minutes of reviews of what Trump said that day. Rick Evans posts, I'm not all that big on act of kindness anecdotes that have become a staple at some news media. On the other hand, it'd be nice if demonstrated sustainable, portable solutions to societal problems got more attention. I won't hold my breath. News media, including NPR, too obsessed with day-to-day Washington politics. I wanted to ask you, Lori Lakin Hutcherson, you started out as a writer and as a, you know, writing for TV and film. What have you learned in building up what was sort of your postings on Facebook into an actual website and aggregator? What have you learned about the news industry from doing this and from the way journalists think and operate?
Well, I've learned that there's an inherent bias in media that, frankly, there's been much more of a spotlight on the media because of the current administration. So the media has been doing, I think, a much better and a stellar job of reasserting itself as the Fifth Estate based on the kind of pressure it's been under. But I would say up until that time, there's a lot of subtle subjugation that goes on, even with something that's supposed to be being presented as fair and balanced in terms of how things are reported about people who are not necessarily, and I'm not just going to say African American, but I would say anybody who isn't in the top of the power structure in the United States. So as I searched for stories, it became more and more apparent and clear to me that oftentimes, even if it was a positive story, the picture of somebody who was a person of color would be dour or sour looking. If there was a headline, it would say black man wins lottery or, you know, becomes head of the Carnegie Hall or something like that, and wouldn't necessarily include their name the way it would be for a white person. Naturally, they wouldn't say white man does this. So oftentimes somebody's skin color or their age or their gender would be presented as the thing as opposed to who they were as an individual. So I really became very acutely aware of that and would try to combat that by essentially rewriting headlines, even if I was curating a story, to add a little more humanity to the presentation of the story.
Gail Rosenblum, you've been inside the belly of the beast for a long time now. How does that comport with what you've experienced in your newsrooms and what you've seen in the industry around you?
Well, you know, so it's so interesting. This conversation is such a good one to have. And what I was thinking was what we're really trying to do is give people back control. I think what's happened over many years is that people feel that they have lost control. And I think what these positive focused stories do is say, actually, there's a lot in your control. And wouldn't we rather live in that kind of a world? And I do appreciate what my colleagues are saying about these stories are impactful. You know, we in Inspired, we cover violence, we cover homelessness, we cover climate change, but we do it in a way that does give people a sense of what they can really do about it. And so I do think we're up against this sort of, you know, man bites dog is sort of the nature of our business. If it's unusual, it is placed on the front page, but how do our readers and viewers, listeners understand that unless they take a journalism class? So I think part of what we need to realize here is it's not an either or like the gentleman who called in with that upsetting story. about the decision, you know, to put a light story on such a devastating day of news. I think it's not an either or, it's an and. And I think we need to train people that these stories are also true. They're as true as the others. And we are going to package them in this way. And we're not going to make them up. We're not going to have to forage in the forest to find them. They're everywhere. But I think in this climate, we've been given permission to package them and present them so that people can see them easily.
We're discussing the big news of good news. We want our guests to stick around, David Beard, Lori Lakin Hutcherson, and of course, Gail Rosenblum. We want you to stick around. Tell us, how does good news find you? How does it affect your thinking about the sources of information you discover and come across? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the push for more positive news in our media landscape. You can join our conversation. What kind of good news stories do you hunger for? What ones do you want to avoid? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. David Beard is with me here in studio. He writes the Recharge newsletter for Mother Jones. Lori Lakin Hutcherson is also with us from Encino, California. She's the editor-in-chief of the website Good Black News. And Gail Rosenblum, we're getting her from St. Paul, Minnesota. She's editor of the Star Tribune's new Inspired section. David Beard, what kind of pushback are you getting? What kind of you know, what are you hearing from those readers who may not be up for this?
Okay, I'll be honest. 2019 is a scruffier, more hard-edged time than 2014 when I started more of an aspirational stories collection for The Washington Post. So I look at 2019. Some of the stories are almost like a younger sibling who gets knocked down a few times and still manages to achieve something. So the stories,
no doubt the inspiration for Chumbawamba. Go right ahead.
Exactly. And so so our stories this today, our story is about threatened monarch butterflies in Mexico. Their place where they hibernate is getting too warm to hibernate, and they're building a forest 1,000, 1,500 feet up the mountainside as a sort of substitute place for them to winter before they come to the eastern U.S. and Canada. And so at first blush, it's not a puppy dog. It's not happy. But it's a resilient move to try to preserve our world in 2019. So I occasionally get, where's my puppy dog? Where's my panda video?
I'd like to take a call now from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim is calling in. Jim, you're on the air.
If you provide more good news stories, will that pay the bills? For example, in the print media, the bottom line, unfortunately, is you've got to sell newspapers.
Well, Jim, great question. Let me pose that question right now to the newspaper editor that we have with us. Gail Rosenblum, up in the Twin Cities, is positive news helping to drive clicks and to actually, it's still important, get people to pay for the paper or subscribe?
Absolutely. That is the bottom line. We have had quite good success with advertising, and we're continuing to look for more. We're doing a speaker series based on good news. We are very popular online. Usually the stories that we publish on Saturday are some of the most popular for several days after that. So that's a great question, and obviously it's on the top of mind of a lot of my editors. And I would say, yes, this is absolutely a win-win. win. It's certainly a win for our readers who are banging down our doors to get more good news, but also it is good potentially for the bottom line.
Gail Rosenblum, you've got now a section. It's called Inspired. It's roughly a year old there at the Star Tribune, one of the nation's largest and most heralded regional metro newspapers, right?
Thank you.
Is that affecting the way in which people in the rest of the newspaper think in the other sections, the other days of the week? Or are we saying, hey, Saturday, have we got something for you folks, but we're going to cudgel you for 6 days a week?
That's a great question. So it's interesting. So I actually don't have a staff. I work with my seasoned writers from around the room. So I work the room constantly to get people all over the paper to participate in Inspired and Write for me. So it's great because there's a lot of voices, a lot of people covering different beat areas, bringing their stories to me. So that's been very helpful. You do see, you know, these positive solutions-based stories all over the paper. But I do think now we've almost trained editors to come to me. It's interesting. At first, there was some cynicism among the, you know, editors, and they tend to be kind of hardcore and cynical, and they weren't sure about this. And my favorite story is one of my kind of crusty night editors pulled me aside and said, all right, I didn't want to like this, but I like it. So and then another one who was like, never going to give me any story. I just walked over and said, I think I got a story for you. So I think people are starting to relax in the newsroom and say, oh, this is actually pretty good journalism. And actually, our readers love it. So maybe I want to jump on board. But no, you'll see these kinds of stories all over the paper. But I think we are kind of the collection for the best of the week. I think that's really what I would say. But certainly it's not we're not the singular good news section. There's good stuff all over.
Let's get feedback from Atlanta, Georgia. Richard is calling. Richard, what are your thoughts?
Well, I remember as an anchor out of San Francisco's Channel 4, we often would speak to public gatherings about how we covered the news. And in those same gatherings, we would, of course, take questions, some of which had to do with really stories that were painful.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
when I would ask, well, did you get the story last night about how we covered teaching kids how to appropriately brush their teeth? And no, they didn't recall. So I think an audience has kind of an exclusive kind of feeling about what they're going to hear and if they recall it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sad. So what you are doing is really, I think, a great advantage to the public. Thank you.
And Richard, thank you. Before you go off the air, can I ask you quickly, when you guys did good stories, I guess it was in San Francisco on the air, were they the kinds of good stories that were ephemeral, or were they the kinds of stories that perhaps we're hearing a little bit more about today?
Well, they had to do with things that people might not normally cover. Maybe you would go into a community around San Francisco and talk about what they were doing to embed it, you know, somehow better the lives of people who live there. And it was a time when there was so much reporting about what was going on that was angering the public. And so I would go to talk about good news, and people would remember only the bad news.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's sad.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Richard, and truly authentically a television anchor's voice. You can hear mm-hmm. it aloud. Lori Lakin Hutcherson, how do you gauge the impact of, say, a story that you think is particularly important? You know, how do you measure whether or not something has struck a chord?
Other than the obvious thing of looking at metrics and seeing how much it's shared, is it going viral, that kind of thing, I would say that looking at the conversation around it and also over time seeing if the conversation changes, one of the things I'm most proud of with Good Black News is that I have constantly, under the banner of Good Black News, included positive stories about LGBTQIA members of the African-American community. And I think, I don't know how many people know, but there is a very strong current of homophobia and transphobia within the African-American community that's not mm-hmm. talked about enough. So I was very, very, very aware that I might lose followers by putting up these stories. And as I predicted in the beginning, people were like, just the comments were very negative. How can you say this is good black news? So on and so forth. But I've literally seen a shift in the past 9 years from that to more likes, more clicks, more within the community, people talking to each other and calling each other out when they have that attitude. So I think sometimes you can take on what are considered to be controversial topics, and if you continue to put them, frame them in a way where this is a positive thing, these are positive people, everybody is a human being who deserves to shine for what they've done to contribute to our world, it can literally help shift people's attitudes, or at least make people feel enough shame to know that they can't just come out and say things that are negative and be revered for them or lauded for them.
Well, we're going to let that be, that good word be the last word on good news for our discussion. We've been talking about the drive for good and meaningful news. You've been hearing there from Lori Lakin Hutcherson. She writes for TV and film and is the founder and editor-in-chief of the website Good Black News. Lori, fantastic to speak with you today.
You too. Thank you so much, David.
We've also been hearing from Gail Rosenblum. She's been in journalism for 40 years, now editor of the Star Tribune's Inspired section in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Gail, thanks for joining us.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thank you.
And David Beard, a longtime journalist, now writer for Mother Jones's Recharge newsletter. David, thanks for joining us here in studio.
Thanks so much, David.
In a moment, the legacy of Notre Dame and a look at its role in French life. This is On Point. In Paris on Monday, flames engulfed the famous Cathedral Notre-Dame de Paris. Its iconic spire collapsed during the blaze. Notable statues of the patron saints of Paris are believed destroyed, and yet, talking about good news, the firefighters worked through the night and were able to save much of the structure just minutes from a total collapse. French President Emmanuel Macron spoke in a televised address last night. We're hearing his words rendered in real time by an interpreter.
We are that people who builds.
Nous avons tant à reconstruire.
We have a lot to build.
Nous rebâtirons la cathédrale Notre-Dame.
We will build the cathedral of Notre-Dame even more beautiful than it was. But this must be done in 5 years. We can do that.
Joining us now from Oberlin, Ohio, to talk about the cultural import of Notre Dame is Eric Ingalls. He's a professor of medieval art history at Oberlin College. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. I'm happy to join you.
You know, Notre Dame is something that's been viewed in person by millions of Americans, as seen in, you know, Disney cartoons by many millions more. Remind us of what Notre Dame actually is, and then let's talk a little bit about what it means to the French people.
Sure. So one thing that's key to remember is that Notre Dame is a cathedral, and we tend to use that term colloquially to mean any big church, but a cathedral is a very specific kind of church. It's the home church of a bishop in his diocese. So Notre Dame is the home church for the Bishop of Paris, and an enormous amount of the attention it's getting now derives from that role, that it was really built in some ways, it was constructed in some ways to be the kind of stage that's receiving this attention today.
So construction began, and these are things you know better than I, but began on the Ile de la Cité, a small island in the middle of the Seine River. It began in 1163 during the reign of King Louis VII, was completed in 1345, almost 200 years later. It's considered a jewel of medieval Gothic architecture. Why?
So one of the key things about that date in the 1160s, and I said, and this goes back to Notre Dame being a cathedral, so the bishop has to answer to an archbishop. And Paris was actually not the archdiocese. That was in a little town called Sens. And in the 1160s, Maurice de Sully, who's the bishop of Paris, is really tired of answering to the archbishop of Sens, which is even then a fairly provincial town. And so he begins construction of a massive cathedral, in part, and not in part, absolutely as an attempt to elevate the status of the diocese of Paris. And one of the very notable things about it, there have been a number of Gothic cathedrals before then. The Cathedral of Paris really inaugurates a height race. So it was about 30 feet taller than any cathedral that had been built before it. And the cathedrals of Chartres and Reims, which are begun immediately afterwards, instantly try to be taller than it. So it's built on a public sphere, and it's built in a competitive environment where the architecture is a way to gain status for the diocese and the bishop.
You know, we think of the incredible damage that we witnessed on television in recent days. You know, not the first time the cathedral's been beaten up. It was really damaged during the French Revolution, if I recall. A lot of the saints had their heads decapitated because the French Revolution were going to a sort of anti-Christian, anti-religion approach. I believe there was significant damage in the 1800s as well. The spire was built during the 19th century. So not all of the things we think of as definitive are really from the Gothic era, right?
No, so you even mentioned at the beginning thing, you know, to effectively finish it, in theory, took 200 years. But I think it's really better to think about a cathedral or any building on this scale, especially a cathedral, as almost as much of a process as a building. And one of the ways a cathedral is interesting is the way that it remains animated through time and attracts things through time. And as you suggested, that includes opposition, not just unanimity. The kind of unanimity we see around the cathedral today is actually probably rare for most of its history, because it is the base for the bishop, and a bishop has opponents as well as friends. So that the French Revolution, as you mentioned, misunderstood statues of biblical kings on the facade, took them for French kings, and decapitated them. They were actually protected by a friend of the cathedral in the late 18th century, and rediscovered buried on the Ile de la Cité in the 1970s. They're now on display at the Medieval Museum in Paris. So the building's gone through incredible vicissitudes like that.
And President Macron is not alone in referring to this as a jewel of France. You know, people gathered. We saw them horror-struck and then cheered by the fact that the cathedral didn't collapse. Ultimately, what has the role been? How symbolically important is Notre-Dame to France's understanding of itself?
Yeah, so already back in the 15th century, during the Hundred Years' War, so this is the period of Joan of Arc and Shakespeare's Henry V and things like that, when the French were looking for symbols of their national identity, they turned to things like Notre Dame in Paris and Gothic architecture more generally to say, this is something that makes us French. This is a reason we can't have an English king. The English don't have any cathedrals as good as that in Notre Dame of Paris. And then that continues into the 17th and the 18th centuries. Because it's the largest church in the city of Paris, any time an important figure like the king needed a public religious stage, Notre Dame provided that stage. So you have very important diplomatic marriages going on there. When diplomats visit the city, they have to visit Notre Dame. It becomes really the embodiment of Catholic France in particular.
Although not technically owned by the church, right?
Not since the 19th century. It is now property of the French state, which is raising questions about insurance and things like that right now in an interesting way.
A different conversation for a different point. During World War II, I saw reports that most of the glass on these gorgeous stained glass windows were destroyed and that it had been rebuilt. Is that essentially what you expect to have happen again?
So I think my sense right now is we don't really know what the situation with the stained glass is and how it was damaged by both the fire and the water used to put out the fire. Mm-hmm. I think much medieval stained glass in large urban environments has already become, since the 13th century, a patchwork of repairs and new windows being put in.
Sure.
And actually, much of the medieval glass was taken out in the 18th century in an attempt to brighten the church and make it seem more fitting for the way the 18th century wanted it to look.
On a personal note, let me say one of my favorite family possessions is a picture of my parents as a young couple in front of Notre Dame. My mother texted me on Monday. She reminded me of my childhood friend Rob when we were palling around Paris with my parents when I was about 10, had given me a small replica of a gargoyle rainspout from Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. She texted, "It used to look childly grotesque to me, but today I think it, yes, stands in for those boys, maybe 10, maybe making fun of each other as they look down at Paris from its center, the only place to see it from, and when you look down from there, the place to be."
Yeah.
We've been talking with Eric Ingalls. He's a professor of medieval art history at Oberlin College. Thank you, Professor, for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm grateful.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Allison Poli, Grace Tatter, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Adam Waller. We've had help from Matt Hoisch, Alex Pena, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Shipman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.